This is the class discussion on Friday, the 26th of April. The class discussion, this is really discussion too. I take the little microphone around to everybody. I don't talk much more than anybody else. On Friday, the 26th, this is after the fine session on Wednesday. I think everybody is a little tired. It's been a warm week. Although it did turn off a little cooler, but it's hot and dry and right discouraging. I don't know just what value this tape is. I'll transfer it just to clear the big tape for next week. All my tape is full of interviews with Hazel. I don't have anything to work with.
You're just starting it. You haven't said what the strength is. Let's take Hester first.
Well, Hester and Ligeia are both sort of separated from society. They're outside the regular activity of society.
Now, start with Hester. What is her strength? What strength does she offer?
Her thoughts. Both women are thinkers. They devote a lot of time to thought.
Now you see, as you make a statement, you sort of like a ray of light penetrating. And then you think about Dimmesdale. Would he want a thought? Is he a man who's influenced by thought, you see?
No, but Hester...
It looks like, now you see, what is it? Now you see, I'm following you follow me. Now what is it, Dimmesdale? He doesn't think, it's not thought he has. Just carry that along a little.
Wait, Dimmesdale doesn't have thought?
No, it's not thought that he has.
No, he has conscience bothering him. His conscience is bothering him.
Well, now you're getting the Puritan side.
Well, Dimmesdale, isn't he almost encapsulated within a certain realm that he cannot come out of because of the institution that he belongs to and the fact that he's, it's been said he's a true religionist. So a true religionist really is not allowed or cannot allow himself to go outside a certain realm, that realm being, standards that the institution in which he belongs sets up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Hester, is not...
Now that idea of thought, that he has thought, that doesn't appeal to you much.
Well, he doesn't.
She doesn't like it. Anybody care that long? Dimmesdale's thought? Thought? Does that help you?
A little bit.
Thought? But thought doesn't help Dimmesdale. It's not thought he's looking for.
No, he's looking for strength.
Yes.
Which Hester supplies.
But you say strength is thought.
No.
Now you're taking it back.
Well, no. Her thinking, first she's separated from society. It's like a chain of events. Okay.
All right,
they're both separated from society. But Hester primarily, she turns to her thoughts because...
For strength.
Well, no, she starts thinking. And through her thoughts, this gives her strength. Well, it's sort of like a mutually interdependent
action. But she doesn't give Dimmesdale thought, she just gives him strength.
Yeah.
Well, now maybe we didn't get very far on this venture, but at least we got a little ways. Let's try it again. Let's start all over again with... this is actually sort of a philosophical method we have, because statement is actually an inquiry. A philosophical statement is an inquiry. Yes. Yeah. Save only through the weakness of his will. So what is that saying now about Ligeia?
She's
supposed to be very beautiful, but there's something strange about her. You know, you just can't put your finger on it. You know, he talks about her eyes and how captivating they are, and so it seems to fascinate him.
That's right. In a way, picking it up from Bacon, and he's inquiring in what beauty, what is the secret of beauty? And he says beauty has some that element of strangeness in it. I don't know how much that helps. And then he's trying to, he's inquiring into that. What is beauty? I don't think we're inquiring into it too much. We take more of a cosmetic view of it. I'm not sure. Maybe just glib, see. Can I say some more? How about just a little bit more? Or you feel like you can almost go down the list. He starts off with her will, you might say. And then there's her beauty and that majestic side of her. And then he, in particular, her eyes. And then, I forget that other one, and then over here I've spoken of her learning, you see, and her metaphysical investigations, and I forget what all else. Now, how do all those things fit in?
And,
I don't talk about transcendence, just talk about...
Like, ...involved with metaphysics. Maybe they had found some answer unconsciously. And they were both had this, and they both willed it so strongly that they can't get it.
We're not really seeing the truth of what she was. So we don't know what she was, except for what we're taking the word of a dope addict as to what she was to him. Now, she may not have been a strong woman to anybody else. In fact, she could have been downright ugly and stupid as hell, you know. But to him, that's what she was. And this guy is obviously a weak person because he's under the influence of opium all the time. Even when his wife is dying, he's sitting there, you know, tripping out, and you know, Caesar looks moving and everything else.
In Tyrol. And saying what it is, you see, he got it wrong. I'm not sure. It may be that Ligeia, in Ligeia, Poe advances the subject over what both the others have done. Hawthorne and
had the view of life of a Puritan, because she was Puritan up until, right, you know, she lived in that society until she was caught in adultery. And then she's got the other side of the view. Like, she's got the view now of life. It's sort of like what the Puritans are always looking at, you know. Now she knows what they're always looking at. They're always looking at sin and things like that. She is sin, if I am. So she's got two views of life. Ligeia, because she is so intelligent, and she's got the metaphysical side, and she's so learned, and also because of her intensity. That's what I got from the poem. She's a very intense person. has more than one view of life. And this is where, and Thoreau, he got above life, he got out of life to look at it, so he got a different view of it. And this is where all these people's strength, I suppose you could say, comes from. The fact that they don't have it, they're not like stick figures, they're real people. You know, where everybody else is really a stick figure because they're so one-sided, they're so flat, one-dimensional. There's no depth to them. There's no depth to their personality. There's only, your personality is made out of your experiences. If you only experience one thing, you know, one thing, different events, or one thing, then you really have developed. You have no size.
To them when they do non-conform, go out of society, whatever you want to call it, and how that they develop their faculties, their intellect, beauty, etc., and intense person. And this is what happened to Thoreau. He left society. I don't think he left life. I think he went into life because the people in society can't live in the present, and he wanted to live for right now. So he left society in his tenderness. And he said, I'm going to remove myself from these things that distract me from living the present. And that's, so he went out to the woods. Ligeia, her faculties were all developed to the fullest, of, and Hester. And they each did it in a different way, one because they were adulterous and they were pushed out of society. But I think that all three of them are trying to say that we're not living life, and that the ones who do transcend society or leave it or to not conform, they are the ones who are living on.
They are the ones who get out of society so that they can see what goes on. Get into it. Now that,
inquiry. But now Hester doesn't have that, does she? Chapter 13. Now you just listen. The world's law was no law for her mind, for it was an age in which the human intellect, newly emancipated, had taken more active and wider reins than for many centuries before. Men were bolder, you see. Hester Prynne imbibed this spirit. She assumed a freedom of speculation. Then, common enough on the other side of the Atlantic, and she had thoughts visited her such as dared to enter no other dwelling in New England. Now, let me tell you, what he's talking to there, you see, is that revolution under what they call the Cartesian Revolution, Descartes and Locke. Now, in order to, is not common anywhere, taking part in that, that is not common anytime, anywhere, so that she has to, Hawthorne actually attributes to her some of that metaphysical ability, or else she can't take part in that. I forgot to say this in class. I'm sticking in this word now as I transfer the tape. Hawthorne could just think of Hester as his own contemporary, who can read the dial and speculate and get into those choice thoughts that he might associate with Margaret Fuller without being metaphysical. Be a pretty good linguist to handle it, the knowledge of language.
Learned quite a bit from him.
Yeah.
Certainly, like, she used to help him or something like that.
Of course, we, yeah. Now, it's your, I don't want, don't let me talk, but you'll talk. Yeah.
We're told that Ligeia does because of the way that her character is sketched out to us in the brief number of pages, but it seems like to me when you're associated with a scholar or something like that, as doubtless that Ligeia had some, passed on some of her knowledge to her husband, I don't see why that we can't say she did or didn't have a metaphysical inquiry, because we're not given everything about Hester. In fact, it's very short about what she does think and everything, and it's not laid out. And I think that all three of these people, Thoreau, Hester, and Ligeia, all had the metaphysical inquiry because when they went out to live life, they developed all their faculties. Maybe one had it more than the other if they studied metaphysics and read all that about it. But just because it's not mentioned, it doesn't mean that I don't see why you say that.
Well, now, Dimmesdale's faculties are laid out.
Yes, but someone said that about living within his realm of the institution. I don't remember who said that, but his faculties are laid out, and apparently seem to be quite well. He's quite proficient at speaking and such, but he is still bound in his little room, or whatever you want to call it, realm of his institution. He could not get on the scaffold the day that they condemned Hester and said, I'm the other half of this crime.
Yeah, well, now that's moral power. As Hester, as he calls it. Hawthorne distinguishes between the moral power and the metaphysical power. That is, Dimmesdale's mind is brilliant on occasion, but his moral force is weak. Hawthorne makes that distinction.
Okay, then he has to be left aside, because if you look at Ligeia, all of her faculties are developed to their fullest, and he's lacking in one area. I mean, this isn't a thing about Ligeia isn't about a person who just had moral strength. She had all of that moral strength, character, personality, intellect, and all that developed to the fullest. She was a like he said, a very intense person. I mean, she was alive. Her eyes, her beauty, etc. And so Dimmesdale was one who was halfway there, if you want to call it that.
Dimmesdale, I think of it being Hester's novel, but it's not. It's Dimmesdale's novel. That makes it a Puritan novel. Hester is the one who is, you might say, Emersonian. But now look at Dimmesdale's power. Carry that over into the fall of the House of Usher, and see if Usher will throw any light on Dimmesdale. I don't know. I guess that came to me. I've never been able quite to feel at home with Usher. I see you read that. You read that all of your life, Fall of the House of Usher. But you read Dimmesdale. Haven't put the two together. Yeah, so let me make a little statement here on the form of the stories. Now, I won't look at the stories. I'll just refer you to them.
You saw it?
Well, when the husband says where he's been describing her,
her intense desire for life. And he mentioned that several times.
Yeah.
I don't mean just the will to be old, to be breathing. I mean be alive in that sense. I mean the will to live life.
Just to live and breathe.
No, I don't mean it in just that, just like words, but I mean to live it to the very fullest.
I think the way it's worked out, though, is to live and breathe, just stay on the earth.
Yeah.
I think that's where it's worked out. See, she dies, doesn't she? And he marries again. Now, what good does that do?
In other words, you have two stories, except you can't have but one. So that the second story has to somehow help the first one. Now, how do you figure that out? I'm trying to get these two freshmen to say something. See, they just, when I look at them, they look at something else. Now, you can answer that question. The first in the cast, Montalotto. Now, what he does there, that's a sort of a thesis. That's his definition, you might say. Oh, I don't like the word definition, it makes it logical. That's his statement on revenge. That's what revenge is. That's revenge, you might say, of a high order. Now, what's that got to do with the story? Right quick, don't think. Cast for Montalotto. What's that got to do with the rest of the story, you see? Now, he puts the terms down here, and then at the end, he says QED. These are the terms that have been demonstrated in this thing. Is that right? I think it is. Now, he says, what's his first statement? Here is. What insults? Yes, you can. What insults?
He just asked, he told me he wasn't in the Brotherhood. And the other guy said it was impossible.
Impossible, you could be a nation. That's an insult. Yeah. You run across somebody, you say, several. I forget what the answer is.
Is that the question?
No, I'm thinking about now the structure of the story. I'm thinking about the structure of Montalotto. You see, the first paragraph states the theme of the story. The story itself amplifies the first paragraph. Now carry that over, that the structure in the structure. Carry that over in the Lygia.
Well, if Lygia is coming back, you know, in the body of this other person, this other woman, maybe she's getting revenge in a way with the fact, you know, death itself.
Now, this is not a story about revenge, see. The story is about the will. If the will is strong enough, there is no death. One dies only through the weakness of his will. That's what this thing says? That's what Glanville said.
That's the theme, isn't it? First course from Glanville?
Yes. Yes.
If that's the whole main point of the story, I mean, that the will, if you have a strong enough will, then you can overcome death. Then the part when she comes back in the shape of the other, in the form of the other woman, when he notices the very last paragraph, whatever it is, when he notices that it's her, it's Lygia, then wouldn't that be the paragraph that more or less moralizes the whole story?
Yes. Now, what happens in Poe is, Poe has, let me tell you, you see that first several pages, you might say the first half of Lygia is not a story. It's an essay. Or it's a discussion. Now that's not a story. It's really going too far to write a first paragraph which states the thesis of the story. That's going a little too far. Stories don't do that. You see, the thesis is not quite so explicit. Well, now look. Suppose you're the writer and you have to work out a thesis like that only through the weakness of the will does one die. How in the world would you work it out? Now, you see, that's what Poe Face is.
He dies because his will is so weak that even Hester can't help him.
No, it's not a little bit different. But anyhow, he dies. But you see, he doesn't let Lygia die. He's got to prove that thesis.
Because Lygia's will is so strong. They're opposite characters. Dimmesdale has no will.
Yeah, but she does die.
But she comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually what Poe's done is written an unbelievable story. But it was believable then. You know why? He's using what they call the Gothic. The Gothic. Everybody, anything that was Gothic in nature, they liked it. That's in Romantic era. You see, Shelley wrote any number of those things before he started writing poetry. And it's the Gothic vessel made sense, and it doesn't make sense here to us. It's a sort of tour de force. But see, now you're working. Now you see, this is the literary side of it, and that's very difficult. I mean, you couldn't. I don't think you can get into that. You kind of have a little help on that. It took me the longest time to get that. Now that's the form of the story. Can you remember that? If you read Poe, you have to know that. It takes a literary person to read Poe. Have to have literary knowledge. You know, skill, literary. Let me tell you. I want you to hear a little bit of this. Where is that? Let me see. Not so much Poe. Where is that? What chapter is that? Do you think I had never read the book? This article. Have you read the Randall Stewart's article? Randall Stewart about Hawthorne as a Puritan? That's way over there. I'm just getting to it. Randall Stewart. Mark it in your book there, in your table of contents. Now, what did we decide about Hawthorne? We're not Puritans. Hawthorne's not a Puritan, but we read the story as if we are Puritans and he's a Puritan. Isn't that what we decided? Huh? So what we were trying to do was to find some point of view that would carry through the book, save us from that pitfall. And that our structure in here. All right, Randall Stewart says that Hawthorne is a Puritan. He's a Puritan of all the Puritans amongst the American writers. That he not only understands the Puritans, but he is a Puritan. And he presented it in such a way, it makes me sort of sad that my view of it. I don't know how they affect you. How do those articles affect you? They make you feel good if you discovered something. I'll tell you how they affect me. They just make me want to find a hole and crawl in it. I just despise to read that sort of material. Just despise it. Just ruins my whole day, week, or weekend. But you know, I have to do it. I simply can't talk to you about the Scarlet Letter unless I know what Randall Stewart says about it. At least they wouldn't let me in the main office there. They wouldn't let me talk to you about it unless they thought I knew the bibliography. Line, you see, a person's got to get used to it.
Okay.
I think the thief thing is to whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered, you see, by the name of goodness, but must inquire if it be goodness. I think that's what we're involved in here. You see, what Emerson says is that every individual is invested with this ability to inquire. And that is the individual. Now, what that does is break through all those things that are not right, not true, not the individual. They break through all these things we've been talking about, the institutions. Oh, I hate to think about anyone now, you see, being a part of the institution, just wholeheartedly a part of the institution. Now, I won't keep it but a half a minute. Just half a minute. Now, you see, that's the thought of Poe, of Hawthorne, of Thoreau, and Emerson is the spokesman for them. He states abstractly what Thoreau is living in Walden and what Hawthorne and Poe are putting into fiction and those stories. Now look, in Moby Dick, you have to see the same thing. Now you look at these people that Melville presents to you, and get acquainted with Ishmael. He's the speaker, you know. And see, just see, let me tell you now, just see how clear these people are. Or you might raise the question, are they clear? You know the best place to read the first 150 pages of Moby Dick? You know the best place? It's one of the few books can be read there. You know where? Right out there, you see, it's a sea story. And this is in Boston, you see, just getting ready to put out to sea. He's gone down there to get a job. Is out where the sea splits on the rocks, and the spray blows all over you. Now, you can do that this weekend. You can take it right down there and read it.
Now, that last suggestion got a response. They were perfectly willing to go down to see the geese over on the beach and read a little bit. They were a little tired. They never quite got into it. But it's such a. What I've asked them to do, you know, is just limitless for them. They've never really faced it before. And that's the end of the tape for Friday, the 26th of April, 68. That's the end of that tape for Friday, the 26th of April, 26. Now I have for the next week, two tapes for Monday and Wednesday. I'm just biding time on Monday and Wednesday, the 29th of April and the 1st of May. I'm just biding time, just waiting for them to read. And I'm trying to find out some of let them work out a little bit before I start talking again. It's rather hard not to set the pace and Moby Dick and draw up little clearer lines on the Scarlet Letter and Poe, but I'm trying to take my time on that. So these 2 days, I'm just biding with time. On Monday, what I had in mind was to just sort of puncture them, just to set the pace, just to offer a suggestion or two. I think most of them had read the first 200 pages of Moby Dick. They can read that without going through the whole book. And they have loose ends.
and they have to make something of it. And I just steered clear of making anything of it. And then on Wednesday, I let them write in class for half an hour. And then at the end of class, I brought up that one point which is so essential for Moby Dick, you see, that's his Yale College and his Harvard. And that puts a whole new view on what takes place in Moby Dick. Now I'll transfer some of this.
But your aunt.
You see, that's what Emerson said about going to church. It's nice to church up until church begins. I just soon just talk a little bit long like you're doing. It suits me. All right, I'll sit down over. I got three vacant seats over there. I'll sit over there. Maybe somebody will talk to me. Think you'll talk. Do you think your natural uninhibited talk in here is as good as the talk in Moby Dick? You know, when I think about my natural uninhibited talk, I shudder. I don't know, just sort of self-protection. I'd rather talk about Moby Dick. Now, the floor is open. Anyone who speaks wants to. I haven't said a thing, you see. All I've done is sort of called the meeting to order. Watch it as you sort of get into it, and then watch it sort of take shape. You see, you have all these marvelous details in here, various things, and you can't take the pictures with you. You know, you have to make something of them. Background we've been talking about, and you'd naturally read that into the material almost inevitably. Now, the first picture, you see, when he gets to following the funeral procession, that's what he can do, you know. And this little picture of the Spouter Inn, that's the name of the title. That's the title of that chapter. That's the Spouter Inn. Now that's in Nantucket? No, that's not. It's the other place. Before he gets to Nantucket? It doesn't matter. Now, the Spouter Inn, now what is he doing there? Yes. The Book of Jonah, four little chapters in the Bible, and one of those apparently added later, there's no such picture of Jonah in that. If you read this, you see, then you mix it up with the picture in the Bible, and you forget which is which. You will actually be thinking about Melville or Ishmael, and he's all wrong. Yes. Now, let me see. Now, the bosom friend is still Queequeg, isn't it? And there's biographical. That's where he comes from, in a wheelbarrow. And then the... Here's another place where they get chowder. This one is not the spouter inn. This is tripods. You know what tripods are? It's that three-legged pot that they use on the whaling ship to boil down the stuff. Now, there's the chowder, you see. Now, this is a different... Mrs. Hussey, isn't that her name? Yeah, Mrs. Hussey. Now, here's the first sight of the Pequod. That's the one they're going to live on, you see, as long as you go to university. 4 years. And they sign on for the, what they call the lay. Now look, here's P-Leg. And who's the other one, the co-owner? P-Leg and Bildad. Oh, now they're marvelous, you see. You see what they are? You know what they are? Stephen Vincent Benet puts them into John Brown's body. They are the Christian slave dealers. They're marvelous. They're marvelous. We'll talk about that a little bit. Now I'm just running through it. And the ship, you see, this ship, or one like it, Captain Morgan, is still up there that you can go on. Some of you have been there. Now, what is this Ramadan thing he talks about? I'm just turning through it. Ramadan, or how do you pronounce it? Go ahead. Provisioning the thing. Now, I forget what's in the Advocate. Material. Now, let me see. Now, you see, it's not to interfere with your reading. Just read, look. Let me see.
If you speak
out on what I call a tangent, or as Emerson put it in that little fable, you see, you join a folk fable, we don't deny it's your voice, you hear the voice. But the voice may be from below, as well as above. So what are you going to do? Just stay in society and take your cue all the time and play safe? University of Tennessee. At one time, and I thought the football team there, they never lost hardly, but it seemed to me like they played the dullest game. They played for the breaks. They played safe. They were good enough to do that. Makes a mighty poor game. See, the coach always gets rehired. But it's a pretty dull game. Now you can play all this safe, you know. I somehow, now you see, don't tell these things I talk to you about. You know when I'm talking to you just privately. And then when you can quote me. I can't hardly seem to bring myself to go to the same church every Sunday. I just can't do it. I always feel like I'm missing something over the other place. I shop around, you see, and that's not good, you see. An institution can't flourish if all the members shop around. You see, if you don't like Senator McCarthy, you know how it is. You never know which side you're on. And somebody's got to man the booths. I found that only one minister in that whole locality area had a
language, you see, that was lofty. The rest of them were pretty plain spoken, you might say. Oh, they varied and differed and all like that. They weren't the same by any means. But just one. And he can say, stand up and sing this song and make you feel like it was a noble occasion. Try this on Hester, on Scarlet Letter. Maybe we ought to. I read that one little passage to you. You know, from the scaffold with that light on the pump and all. I don't know, but Hawthorne's supposed to sound a certain way. Now, you see, what I would normally do, it'd be embarrassing. I'd just let you read it. If you read this, what'd it sound like? How that first line sounds. He got me there, the very beginning. Call me Ishmael. Now don't look, listen. Now some years ago, never mind how many precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing in particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it's a damn drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I count it high time to go to sea. Now, when I say I am in the habit of going to sea, whenever I begin to grow hazy about the eyes and to begin to be overconscious of my lungs, I do not mean to have it inferred that I ever go to sea as a passenger. For to go as a passenger, you must needs have a purse. And a purse is but a rag unless you have something in it. And passengers get seasick. They grow quarrelsome. They don't sleep at night. Do not enjoy themselves much, as the general saying. No, I never go as a passenger. No, though I'm something of a salt. Do I ever go to sea as a commodore or a captain or a cook? I abandon the glory and distinction of such offices to those who like them. For my part, I abominate all such honorable, respectable toils, trials, tribulations of every kind whatsoever. It's quite as much as I can do to take care of myself without taking care of ships, barks, brigs, schooners, and whatnot. And as for going as cook, though I confess there's considerable glory in that, a cook being a sort of officer on shipboard, yet somehow I never fancied broiling fowls. Though once broiled, judiciously buttered, and judgmatically salted, there's no one who will speak more respectfully, not to say reverentially, of a broiled fowl than I will. No, when I go to sea, I go as a simple sailor, right before the mast, plumb down into the forecastle, aloft there to the royal masthead. True, they rather order me about some, and make me jump from spar to spar like a grasshopper in a May meadow. And at first, this sort of thing is unpleasant enough. It touches one's sense of honor, particularly if you come of an old established family in the land, the Van Rensselaers, the Randolphs, the Hardy Canutes. And more than that, if just previous to putting your hand into the tar pots, you've been lording it as a country school teacher, making the tallest boys stand in awe of you. The transition is a keen one, I assure you, from a schoolmaster to a sailor, and requires a strong concoction of Seneca and the Stoics to enable you to grin and bear it. But even this wears off in time. Now what of it? If some old hunks of a sea captain orders me to get a broom and sweep down the decks, what does that indignity amount to, weighed, I mean, in the scales of the New Testament? Do you think the Archangel Gabriel thinks anything the less of me because I promptly and respectfully obey this old hunks in that particular instance? Who ain't a slave? Tell me that. Well then, however the old sea captain may order me about, however they may thump and punch me about, I have the satisfaction of knowing that it's all right, that everybody else in one way or another is served in much the same way, either in a physical or metaphysical point of view. And so the universal thump is passed around. Should rub each other's shoulder blades and be content. Now that whole book is sung. As you read it, you sing it. It's written in a rhetoric of the sea. Every breath of it is salty. And it's like the old man talking, you see. Not old man, it's like the man talking. He's talking to you and you hear him talk. Somehow or other, you hear him talk. Nice. I sort of got hardened to the high school graduates saying as freshmen up here that they started to read all these books from Moby Dick. They wanted to become educated, you see, and well-read. And they read 100 pages and bogged down. But I can't say to them, you haven't read it. You haven't heard it, you see. I can't say that to him. Won't do a bit of good. You see, they didn't bog down Moby Dick. They never did get into Moby Dick. Yes, John. Now, this is the end of that Monday. This is the end of Monday. I forget the date, and it's about 7:50. On the sunny dial, it's about 7:50, and this is Monday. Now I think I'll transfer the tape for Wednesday. For Wednesday, May the 1st. Then I'll transfer the tape for Wednesday, May the 1st. And as I said at the beginning of the Monday tape, this week, I'm just holding back and letting them read and try to put the pieces together and not indoctrinate them. Just hold off as long as I can. Of course, just a few little remarks colors their reading just so much. And this is now at 7:65, and this is the tape for Wednesday, the 1st of May, 1968. You know, to the instructor, a class is always dull if he's not talking. Now, I think now, if I were in the class, it would be a dull class if I wasn't talking, sure. The only trouble is, most talk is emotional. It's not really rational, it's emotional. I say now, all right, you've got the background. Go ahead and write for 20 or 30 minutes about the book. And somehow you've got to get it out of your system that Melville has got such a slow pace and he doesn't leave anything to the imagination. He's so wordy. Huh? And see, you just waste time talking about things like that. That's just emotional. I don't know when I learned this. Now you talk back. But I finally, I'm not introspective. I've never really been able to observe myself well enough. You see, whenever you do anything, you ought to be able to sort of observe it at the same time. That makes you objective. But somewhere along the line, I found out that, say, the first 100 pages of a book, I was fighting with the writer all the time, just fighting with him. I was trying to come to grips with it, and I was having a hard time, you see, and I was trying to get my mind on it. My mind would wander. I don't know whether you do that or not. I imagine you do. Yeah? Yes, isn't it? A lot more. Yeah. You ever Tom Jones?
Yeah.
You know how Tom Jones is written?
Yeah. Very tediously.
Now bring that up. Bring that up. I think the person has to have Tom Jones behind him in order to appreciate this. I heard it do. Bring that up after a while. We don't have time to go into it. Yes. Don't give me the mood when I ask you to go ahead and talk about this. Huh? I don't want the mood. So now you see, that puts you on your defensive, doesn't it? You're going to say, well, what does he want? After all, I'm the instructor. Anybody who is instructor, you say, well, what does he want? So you're actually right to please the instructor. You know what I could do? And I think it's done. Now, you're not through taking literature courses. I don't know about other courses. Yes, you can do the same thing about the Napoleonic period of history. You can take up one writer after another and go into him and give his merits and demerits and see and come out with a general impression that this is what he lacked. Yes, sir. You can do that. Any writer can do it. The professor can do that. I don't know whether professors do that or not. You take more literature courses. I see the Napoleonic period in history was a period of great accomplishment. They even changed the weights, you see. They went to the metric system. Well, anyone who can overcome tradition and go into something like that has done pretty well. That's a type of thing was done in the Napoleonic period. Oh, yes. Now, that's all I'd say. I'd say the instructor. In this case, you see, we've not made any observations about this. Your obligation, I think the obligation is, in reading it for yourself, it's the same thing. The obligation is to make something of it.
Yes,
sir. Something that will hold up. Something that will be true to your experience or somebody's experience. And something that has something to say worth hearing. Okay. What I do is make something of it, the best you can, in terms of the course of our discussions. I write an ink on every other line that makes it easier on me to read. Now this, I ask you to do this. I didn't say you could if you wanted to. I said do it. I want everybody to work hard on it. I'm going to read these all around. I'll take them out with me when I feed the cows. And I'll sit down and read two or three, and I'll go ahead and cuss the cows. Make something out of it.
Now, they write for 30 minutes, and I have 10 minutes left to work with them just a little bit. I can't resist putting in a word, as you'll see, this particular word, but they have been writing for 30 minutes, and now I have about 5 or 10 minutes to talk to them.
At the beginning of chapter XXV, done in that is to, as advocate, He speaks of the honor and glory of whaling. And this is final tribute to it. And one sentence here, I'll have to have your attention now. If he has amounted to, if he ever amounts to anything in the world, there be any as yet undiscovered prime thing in me, and on in that detailed way that he has, he will owe it to his experience in whaling. And then look at the last sentence, or part of a sentence. For a whale ship was my Yale College and my Harvard. You have to view Moby Dick as his Yale College and his Harvard. Some get in Yale College, he gets on a whaling voyage. Only he comes to grip with it much more than anyone can in Yale College and in Harvard. There they study biology in the laboratory, and they have formaldehyde alcohol on their fingers, and he studies it there on the side of the ship. All conceivable ways does he study the outside world. The world outside. One little statement will change your view of the book. You look at the book in that light, and eventually it'll change your whole view of yourself. He has this little thing, you know, even these little chapters that you just forget about, if you stop on them, you'll see such extraordinary things. Oh, you last, I've read this little chapter called The Ship a half dozen times. I just can't seem to get past it. I want to read it and reread it. He says, good again. Then thou not only...